One final presentation before we open it up for discussion. Justus Uttermark.
Thanks a lot. It has been said before, but I do want to say it again. It is a great honor to be here, and it's also, of course, very difficult now for me to say something original, because people have already criticized a lot of processes that are going on at the moment, and I will also be talking in a way about gentrification, about displacement, and how it is being legitimated. But I will try to do so from a slightly different perspective. So my starting point for analysis is that in Western Europe and in the US, there is now advanced marginality. And I take Loic Wacan's definition, and he claims that advanced marginality results from these four processes. And I won't read them out because I know I am in a hurry. So the important point here is that advanced marginality, of course, poses a problem for the people who suffer from it. But it also poses a problem for authorities, for governments. Because naturally, people who are unemployed, stigmatized, and concentrated in certain areas will not have a lot of loyalty to the existing order. So, and these people also use a lot of services and provisions and so on. So you see that a lot of authorities in and around these neighborhoods consider these people as a problem. And so my question is, how do states govern marginalized populations and marginalized neighborhoods? Now, one answer that the literature gives is simply that they are segregated and relegated to ghettos. So this is, for instance, the answer that Loic Wacan gives in his book on urban outcasts, especially where the US is concerned. And of course, I see those processes, and I also see that they are increasing in Europe as the urban landscape is neoliberalizing. However, I also think that there is something else going on. And one hint that this is the case is that, in fact, a lot of politicians in Europe constantly talk about integration, and they are deeply concerned about these neighborhoods, and they're anxious about what is happening there. So basically, I want to ask some questions. What explains the intensity of these interventions, and what explains the concerns that these policymakers have, and what is the nature of these interventions? So then I will give some illustrations from case study research in the Netherlands. And then I want to end by saying, how do we provide a critique of these interventions? And to remind you, these are interventions that are being carried out under the banner of integration. So it is something that most of us here would also support. Like, who is against integration? Well, I am. And I will try to explain why. So I will just rush over this. So why do Western European countries care so much about these neighborhoods? Well, I think because there are interdependencies that link these neighborhoods to central states. So basically, central states are affected by what happens in these neighborhoods. And you can have economic linkages. For instance, in the Dutch case, if schools perform bad, this immediately comes on the plate of the national government because it finances education completely. It's the same for the police, for instance. Now, this is very different from the US. And I mentioned a couple of other interdependencies here, but the basic point is this. If things explode in these neighborhoods, it is also a problem for central states. So it is not the level of advanced marginality per se, which is much higher in the US, that explains the intensity of investments, but the position of local state and quasi-state actors in national configurations. So in other words, policy is meant to support institutional actors rather than residents. So by this, I mean that advanced marginality, basically governments have given up on solving advanced marginality. They are not aspiring anymore to full employment, and they have given up on a lot of their emancipatory goals. However, Where advanced marginality leads to explosive situations, you see that the state rushes in. And in the Netherlands, this takes the form of civilizing offenses. And here I draw from research that I've done with Jan-Willem Duivendak, and we observe that in Rotterdam, for instance, there are a lot of policies around citizenship. Another fantastic word, like who could be against citizenship? Well, again, I am, because of the way it is being implemented. So just to give you one example about the complicity of scholars in these processes. They also say, oh, those problems, those neighborhoods, they have so many problems. We need to reconquer them. We need to reconquer the neighborhood. So this is now actually official Dutch policy. And I think the Netherlands may be an extreme case, but I think you can see similar processes in other countries, similar policies in other countries. I think you can see them in the US, and I think you can especially see them in strong welfare states because they are most centralized and they are most affected by what happens in these neighborhoods. So, as you know by now, I am suspicious of these policies. So, although disinvestment and segregation obviously contribute to the reproduction of inequality and injustice, it cannot be assumed that these area-based policies, these investments and integration policies, promote equality and justice. So, what did I observe with Jan-Willem Duivendak in Rotterdam? The government is massively present in marginalized neighborhoods, and it invests heavily in the governance of those neighborhoods, so not in the people themselves. So you see all sorts of institutions being created, all sorts of programs to instill in residents an idea of civic engagement. So these are civilizing offensive, and people are now forced to take language courses, for instance. They are forced to send their children to preschool activities. Children are being stopped on the street if it is suspected that they might have to be at school, and so on, and so on, and so on. So this is a sort of reinvention of the punitive paternalism that we know from the early days of industrial capitalism. But what is different is that state policy has now adopted many of the concepts that were previously promoted by social movements. Emancipation, for instance, is now something that is actively demanded by the government. So people have to get involved. They cannot just stay at home. And of course, this only applies to people in disadvantaged neighborhoods. Other people are never, like literally people ring on people's bells and say, hey, you need to get involved with your street. You need to do something here. So citizenship, another example that I just mentioned, it used to be a demand by minority organizations, but now it is demanded of minorities. So it is not in itself disconcerting that the government adopts these concepts. It is disconcerting that it distorts these concepts. So let me give the example of livability. So livability, again, it's a good thing, right? I mean, you don't want to live in an unlivable neighborhood. And actually, livability was a slogan of a lot of protesters in the 1970s and 1980s when they protested against large-scale demolitions. They said, we want human-scale interventions. We want to remain in our houses. We want rent protection. We want to live in this neighborhood, so it has to be livable. So housing associations and governments have now adopted this notion of livability. And they also say, we promote it. But if you look how they define it, and they define it very precisely because they even have a livability monitor, we see that they mean something completely different. So perception of residents are still included in the operationalization, in the score. But also so-called objective criteria are used. So if a neighborhood has a high share of ethnic minorities, the score goes down. If a neighborhood has a high share of lower income households, the score goes down. If it has a high share of affordable housing, the score goes down. So this is kind of amazing. If you are being kicked out of your house and you are forced to relocate to another neighborhood, that means that your neighborhood has become more livable. So it is this sort of Kafkaesque redefinition of concepts that is now very typical of Dutch urban policies, and I think policies generally. So also, first we had a policy for disadvantaged neighborhoods, and then they felt, oh, it's stigmatizing. So now we call it a policy for fantastic neighborhoods. And this is literally how they call it. So just to move to another policy measure that seems to be always in the mix of policy measures, and this is social mixing. So if we come to realize that these policy definitions and measures reflect the interests of governance actors rather than residents, we can also better understand these mixing policies. It is a core component of attempts to reconquer the neighborhood. And academics have time and time again said that these policies do not work. Poor people do not benefit if there are high incomes nearby. But they do work. They do just not work for residents. So I think these policies are used to discipline these populations to reconquer neighborhoods. And this is not just a suspicion. Also, researchers find that time and time again, like social mixing provides these institutional actors with a way to keep out poor residents. And also it brings into the neighborhood residents that will help to govern the neighborhood along with housing associations, the police, and so on. So they come to neighborhood meetings, they call the police when there's something wrong, they vote, and they vote for mainstream parties. So these are the people that you literally want in your neighborhood, and that is also why they do it. So just one snapshot of a research project that I did with Jan-Willem Dijverdak and Reinhard Kleinhans. So this is Hoogvliet in Rotterdam, and a post-war neighborhood with a lot of high-rise houses, almost completely composed of social housing. And then there was a drastic restructuring operation, which is basically gentrification, but then in the most marginalized neighborhoods. So the result is not like a very gentrified area, but it is a mixed area. So what do residents say about these interventions? Well, social cohesion went down a lot. Social involvement went down a lot. But here, look at livability, it went up. And that is also because the researchers who are actually employed by housing associations, I used these data, I wasn't employed by them, defined livability as clean, safe, and well-maintained. And of course, these new houses were clean, safe, and well-maintained. It is just that all the existing ties in the neighborhoods were basically destructed by these interventions. So segregation may be a problem, but integration policies are not necessarily the solution. And I think there's also a danger at some point in defending society and saying, oh, society is about to collapse and inequalities are rising. Because what you then get are policies that aim to neutralize this danger. And I think that this is what we see in the Netherlands. So you see that in these neighborhoods, civil society has been completely destroyed. And I find this particularly interesting and also important in the light of discussions that we've been having here, because these policies, these social mixing policies, are carried out by the very same organizations that used to prevent gentrification. In Amsterdam, just 10 years ago, almost all houses would be social houses, and housing corporations were public in 1990 still. But they have transformed themselves at incredible speed. So they have basically been taken away from residents, and they now have their own agenda. And although they cannot formally make a profit, they have to make a profit on some projects, and yeah, they just continue to build their reserves and so on. So housing associations have been taken away, but also civil society associations. So the community workers who used to fight alongside neighborhood residents to protest against demolitions now, as they say, streamline the process. And they consider themselves now as mediators between the housing associations and residents. And this basically means that they tell residents, oh, you should look for a new house and you should accept your relocation money and you should just leave because the plan cannot be changed. So I think the Dutch case is especially interesting because it is still held up by some people as at least Amsterdam is, as an ideal city or a just city. And I can understand that. Like, by international standards, it may be an ideal or just city. But what is really remarkable is that it is an example of a city that has turned around so quickly and that moves from redistributive and emancipatory policies to policies that promote gentrification. And what is most striking is that there's hardly any resistance. And this is because the overwhelming force of these housing associations, of community workers, of the state. So I think that should also give food for thought for people who at least think that in the United States there's now a moment of hope. I, for one, wouldn't call for the nationalization, for instance, of housing. And I wouldn't trust too much on the government. Because you can see that the government very easily turns against the people, and then it is a massive force. So I would expect, I need to test it, that gentrification in Amsterdam is now proceeding faster than in other cities. Because housing associations have virtually unlimited capacity to tell people they need to leave and to demolish their houses, and they have full cooperation of the government, which would be unthinkable, I think, if it was just be private landlords who, in a way, are not seen and still not seen as legitimate partners of the government. So I would pick up one of the suggestions that was made earlier in the panel. If you are going to be in the fortunate situation that you're going to bail out people, don't nationalize their property, turn it into corporations, and make sure that when the tide turns, you will control your own city. Thanks.